Questions? Yes.
What evidence is there against Sir Hamm? What is this? What evidence did they actually declare him guilty with, and what evidence survives for the new case?
Well, the evidence against him is non-existent. That is to say, they can't match. They can't even authenticate the gun in the archives as his weapon. They cannot match the victim bullets with test bullets from the weapon that's in the archives. The eyewitnesses place him in a position that is contrary to the autopsy report. It's clear that he is not the person who shot Robert Kennedy. I've given you, it seems to me, convincing proof that Sirhan was not the person who shot Robert Kennedy and that he was actually in a trance at the time the shooting took place.
What evidence did they have originally?
Well, I've described to you what evidence they had originally.
And that's all disappeared.
And this evidence was obviously not evidence that would have implicated Sirhan, otherwise they would have destroyed it. So the answer is there was no evidence that would have implicated Sirhan. The evidence has always exonerated Sirhan, and they've done their best to destroy what they can of that. And that's proven by the autopsy report and by the observations of witnesses who saw extra bullets in the crime scene. Does that answer your question? The evidence is fake evidence. The evidence presented at trial consisted of fraudulent evidence, consisted of fraudulent bullets, and probably a substitute gun. Yes?
Could you expand upon that a little bit on his question? Could you go say a little bit about the Sirhan's malice aforethought comment, his so-called confession?
Yes. The prosecution loves to trumpet the fact that Sirhan, in the middle of his trial, blurted out, "I have premeditated this crime with 20 years of malice aforethought." That was an off-the-cuff remark that was made in the course of a frustrated outburst on Sirhan's part, in which he was attempting to get the court to allow him to represent himself and to relieve his attorneys. That's all it was. But that appears in news releases. It appears in the state Supreme Court's opinion. It also appears in parole hearings. Again and again, they trumpet that. It doesn't mean anything. It's a spontaneous outburst that is not a genuine reflection of what he did. I mean, if you take that comment at face value, Sirhan, who was 24 at the time, began planning the assassination of Robert Kennedy when he was 4 years old, before he could possibly have heard of Robert Kennedy. It's preposterous. I must tell you something else about the utter lack of a motive. I'm glad you brought this up. As it happens, Sirhan was motiveless. We know that from a discussion that took place between Sirhan and the prosecution's psychiatrist, Seymour Pollock. Sirhan, how could you do such a thing? Answer, I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out. I would have supported Robert Kennedy. I would have voted for him. He was for the underdog. Yeah. So he had no motive. He didn't want this death to take place. And you can hear on the tape of this interview an audible groan from Dr. Pollock, as though to say, my God, we don't have a motive. We're really in trouble on this case. So they cooked one up. And the motive they cooked up was the so-called phantom jet motive. As the prosecution would have us believe, Sirhan had heard a broadcast in which it was made mention that Robert Kennedy was going to support the sale of phantom jets to Israel. And he raced into his room and wrote down, RFK must be assassinated, RFK must die, RFK must be killed, etc., up and down the page. That's what supposedly got him started planning out the assassination. But there's a problem. The broadcast that Sirhan heard, the first broadcast he could have heard in Los Angeles with reference to Kennedy, occurred 2 days after that notation, which is dated, and it doesn't make any mention of phantom jets. So the prosecution doesn't have a motive. But that didn't stop compromised defense attorney Grant Cooper from jointly sponsoring this fake phantom jet motive to the jury. This motive, this so-called motive, a non-existent motive, was unjustly presented not only by the prosecution but by the defense against Sirhan. The defense also asked the jury to believe that Sirhan's repeat writing was the product of his following recommendations in Rosicrucian literature, which recommended that people write things down repeatedly to get themselves willing to do it. But as I've said, first of all, why is a defense attorney putting on this kind of evidence, assuming it's even credible? Why is he putting it on? That's not the sort of thing that does anything except walk your client straight into a gas chamber. He's doing that because he's working off a beef from the U.S. Attorney's Office across the street. But also, if Sirhan was aware of having planned the assassination, he wouldn't have amnesia. And we know he has amnesia because under hypnosis, he couldn't even reenact the crime. So the amnesia is genuine. So that's my response to the allegation that he said 20 years of malice aforethought. That pops up in all these press releases put out by the government and their apologists. There's nothing to it. They don't bother to mention in context, this was not a confession. It was an off-the-cuff comment in which he said, in effect, all right, you want me? Sure, I'm guilty. That's the closest they claim came to a guilty plea. He also said, I don't remember. He never deviated from that. You can't have 20 years of malice aforethought and I don't remember at the same time. Those are incompatible statements. And the amnesia is a genuine phenomenon, as demonstrated by the fact that amnesia was not shaken by hypnosis. They couldn't get him to reenact the assassination. Reach for the gun. He reached for his crotch. Nobody denies that. So there is absolutely true amnesia as a product of hypnoprogramming. I should mention that my expert in this case is Herbert Spiegel, who teaches at Columbia University, widely recognized as the world's leading expert on hypnosis. These are the conclusions he's come to, that Sirhan was hypnotized to walk in fire with no memory and no knowledge of what he was doing and no ability to recall the programming process or any of the events leading up to or associated with the crime.
Do you think he was a brain control victim?
Yes, that's right. That's what I've said all along.
Where, at what point in his history would he have been in a position to do that? Like, was he in the Army or something?
He wasn't in the Army. He wasn't in the Army, but there are indications that this happened a significant... The question is, let me repeat the question. If you bring back the microphone.
You have the mic.
Okay, right. I'll repeat the question. The question is, at what point did this programming process take place? Well, we don't know exactly. We don't know who did it. There are indications, but we do know that there is reason to believe that this programming began a significant period of time before the assassination. There was a hypnotist who gave a demonstration in Pasadena about 2 years before the assassination. And after the assassination, this hypnotist was contacted about the case. And he said, yes, I remember Sirhan. I write down the names of all people who come up on the stage and agree to be subjects for my audience. And I wrote down Sirhan's name. So I have a card with his name on it. And I remember him because he was an experienced hypnotic subject at the time he performed, and he performed very well. This was 2 years before the assassination. So somebody was working on him quite some time before the assassination. This was not something that just took place. There was advanced preparation 2 years. What did I say about John Rosselli, 1966, in which the FBI was working out a way to leverage him with photographs that would confirm that he came into the country illegally? Oh, and by the way, you know the government never charged Rosselli with theft of the transcripts? Why would they? He performed a service for them. I think that's one of the most telling pieces of evidence there is in the entire matter. They went after Rosselli for immigration fraud to leverage him. They went after him for the Friars Club case to put him in proximity to these lawyers whom he was going to set up. But they never prosecuted him for theft of the transcripts because in stealing the transcripts, he was working for them. That's why he was being leveraged. And I think that is extremely telling. And that's one of the issues that I would like to explore at an evidentiary hearing. Why wasn't Rosselli charged with theft of the transcripts? Because the government's own documents prove that he was involved in stealing the grand jury transcripts before the assassination. Why wasn't he charged? They went after him big time in these two other matters. Why let him go in that case? Well, because he was working for them, which means they were in on it. There was somebody else who wanted to ask something.
Yes. I was wondering about the background of Sirhan. Is that how would someone get exposed to him to sort of figure out that he would be a likely candidate for this? Did he live alone? Was he an isolated person? Did he have a job that connected him with people in some way?
All right. The question is, how would they gain access to information that Sirhan would be a good hypnotic subject? And the answer is that Sirhan was the kind of a guy who would go to demonstrations of hypnosis and offer his services at the on the stage. He would volunteer. We know that from two independent sources. Right before the assassination, he went to a session of the Rosicrucians in Pasadena. And there are reports that he volunteered to present, to participate in a Rosicrucian experiment on stage. He would close his eyes, his arms were to be extended, and he would be blindfolded, and he would be asked to identify objects that were placed on his arms. This is called the tactile sensation experiment. But the significance of it is that here we have Sirhan, shortly before the assassination, volunteering to go up on stage in front of a group of people and participate in some sort of psychic experiment. So he's the kind of a guy who does this. He did it 2 years before the assassination when he volunteered in Pasadena to be a subject of hypnosis. Oh, you can use me, put me under hypnosis, see what you can get me to do. So anybody observing this event 2 years before the assassination would have had no difficulty realizing Sirhan was what Dr. Spiegel calls a hypnosis virtuoso. And the hypnotist who put him under 2 years before the assassination said he was already an experienced subject. So this had happened before. That's, in my opinion, how they picked Sirhan up. And they wanted somebody from the Middle East so they could claim that the Middle East was involved in the assassination, or that there was a Middle East-related motive. The last thing they wanted was for people to have any room to speculate that Vietnam was involved in this assassination, because that was their motive. So they chose a different part of the world, and the part of the world they chose enabled them to claim, Sirhan, Palestinian fanatic, Arab terrorist. Does that combination of words ring familiar these days? Mm-hmm. See how clever that was? That was an anticipatory show of bias against the Palestinian people. They were capitalizing on it even then. And this was in 1968, just 1 year after the 67 war. So that's, I think, how Sirhan was picked up. Oh, there's something else. Sirhan knew how to use a 22. Where did he learn this? In ROTC in high school in Pasadena. The U.S. Army would have known that.
Was he in the Army?
No, he was not. But he was in ROTC.
Did he say that he brought a gun to the pantry area that night?
He had no memory of having done anything there, but at one point he acknowledged in his questioning on the stand that he must have brought a gun to the assassination scene.
Why must he have?
Well, because he said at one point that he brought the gun from his... He had the gun in his car from the sessions that he had over at the gun range earlier that day. And at some point he realized that the gun would be unsafe in his car, so he went back to his car and got the gun.
Do you think Thane Eugene Caesar was the only other shooter, or only shooter, confirmed shooter in the room?
No, I don't, but before, the question is, was Thane Eugene Caesar the only other confirmed shooter in the room? No, I'm not saying that Thane Caesar was the person who shot Robert Kennedy, but there is overwhelming reason to suspect that he may have, and that he's somebody who should have been focused on by the defense and the prosecution, both of which gave Caesar the right to skate out of the courtroom. In fact, he was never called. His weapon was never testified. It was test-fired. So there were, in my opinion, yes, there are other people who shot weapons in the room. And let me back up to the subject of what Sirhan said about his going back to the car to get the weapon. That's an important point. Sirhan was given unrestricted access to the prosecution's psychiatrist, who was allowed to hypnotize him with nobody else in the room. Grant Cooper, who was working off this beef from the U.S. Attorney's Office, made that brilliant decision. It was after this access had been granted that Sirhan began to be amenable to accounts that the prosecution would find useful to its case. I've just given you one of them. Another was the version of events submitted by his own attorney that Sirhan had used Rosicrucian literature to prepare himself for the assassination. Sirhan had no knowledge of this, but he then gets worked on by the prosecution psychiatrist, after which his own attorney leads him into admitting that that's what must have happened. In truth, he had no memory of it.
Well, so you can see Rosicrucian literature was used to put him in some sort of murderous trance?
It's preposterous, isn't it?
Well, is that what you're saying?
No, it wasn't.
Well, I mean, is that what they're saying?
The prosecution, with the assistance of an all too eager to please Grant Cooper, presented the argument that Rosicrucian literature was used by Sirhan to reinforce his willingness to carry out the act of killing Robert Kennedy. That was their claim. They came up with that. I know that that cannot be true because Sirhan has amnesia of the event that is not shaken by hypnosis. This was a theory that was concocted by the prosecution and the second prosecutor in the courtroom, Grant Cooper, who was being blackmailed by the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's nonsense. And there's no reason a defense attorney would present that kind of so-called evidence unless he had ulterior motives. That's not defense evidence. That's prosecution evidence. And it's nonsensical.
Do you have any idea how many bullets actually were expended in the room?
Well, at least 10, because there were at least two extra bullets demonstrated by crime scene evidence. Also, there is sound evidence that points toward an even higher number of bullets being expended in the room. More bullets were fired than could have come from Sirhan's weapon. From Sirhan's weapon. Let me put that in quotes, because the weapon up at the archives is not Sirhan's weapon. They switched bullets, they switched guns, they destroyed extra bullets, they destroyed the extra gun, they incinerated photographs. They did everything. And the basic thing they did is they blackmailed the lawyer into making sure that none of this came out. And they blackmailed the lawyer as a result of a CIA plot that was generated before the assassination. The key actor in that plot was involved in the anti-Castro plots, the same plots in which Oswald was apparently involved before he became the fall guy for the JFK case. If that doesn't link these two cases together, I don't know what would. Yes.
What is the situation now? You have won a new trial, is that it?
Well, I would like to get a new trial. The question is, have I won a new trial? The answer is no. The proceedings are now underway in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, in which I'm seeking a new trial for Sirhan. I'm having some problems with that, and I've tried to explain why that's the case. The magistrate judge to whom the matter is decided has been assigned for decision is a subordinate of a district judge in the courthouse who used to be U.S. attorney and who was involved in the process of compromising Grant Cooper. So no new trial has been granted, but there are obstacles to getting that, and I'm working on resolving those obstacles. It's a battle. It's a battle royale. And there are very powerful forces with a tremendously compelling vested interest in making sure that I don't get relief in court. That's not to say they're necessarily going to win, but that's what I'm up against.
What's the evidence that Grant Cooper actually possessed those stolen transcripts in January of '68? I mean, how solid is that evidence?
Well, Grant Cooper seems to have acknowledged that he did. I take it as established from the government's own memoranda that Rosselli, together with others, went to Las Vegas and illegally acquired the transcripts and distributed them to a number of lawyers in Los Angeles, one of whom would have been Grant Cooper. And that's what the government claims. Now, that's the government's own claim. And then all of a sudden, Cooper supposedly comes to court with one of these transcripts. Now, maybe he didn't have the transcripts. Maybe the transcripts were just planted. But it's awfully strange that if he had them, he didn't leave them at home. Why is he coming to court leaving them in plain view on his papers for them to be conveniently discovered when he leaves the room? That's not something that anybody would do. So I've come to the conclusion that those transcripts were probably planted by John Rosselli. Now, maybe Cooper had them beforehand, but Rosselli was in position to make sure that they were discovered when the prosecutor was alone in the room with the court reporter, with another court reporter.
And that was during the Friars case.
That's right.
It was discovered.
But this discovery took place after Cooper agreed to represent Sirhan. Very convenient. In other words, here's the sequence. Before the assassination, CIA Rosselli compromises a group of LA lawyers, making it possible for any one of them to be fingered as being in possession of these transcripts. Then one of these lawyers is picked by ACLU lawyer A.L. Wearin to represent Sirhan. He agrees. That lawyer is then the hapless victim of the incredible event of one of these transcripts lying in plain view on top of his papers in the Friars Club case. That lawyer gets targeted to be nailed, and he gets nailed, and then he's blackmailed, and then he throws the case, and the rest is history.
Could you talk a little bit about Allard Lowenstein and also just as a lead into the question, I mean, challenging the forces that you're challenging, I'm just curious about, like, you know, your personal safety and if there have been any threats against you and things like that.
Yeah, I've had threats and I live with them. Allard Lowenstein made an attempt to get Congress involved in a reinvestigation of the case. It didn't go anywhere. Congress looked at the JFK and MLK cases. But the House Assassinations Committee investigation, in my opinion, was completely sabotaged from within and went nowhere as a result of internal sabotage. They wouldn't even go near the RFK case. In my opinion, the reason for that is that there was much more evidence in this case than in the other cases of government misconduct. There was a trial record, after all. There was a trial. It was a show trial. It was a phony trial, but there was a trial record. So that's why.
Good autopsy, right?
And there was a valid autopsy, unlike the situation in Dallas, where there was an autopsy of which many people feel autopsied a tampered with body. That didn't happen here. The autopsy in Los Angeles was a devastating blow to the prosecution. For this plot not to come unraveled, they had to make sure that Sirhan's representation was being handled by somebody they can control through blackmail. Can you imagine what would have happened if Sirhan had an honest lawyer? If he had been represented by the Public Defender's Office, the Public Defender's Office would have made hay with that autopsy report and at least saved him from the death penalty. Well, that would have exposed the plot. And Hubert Humphrey could have gotten elected by an electorate that said, we don't want another Dallas. That wouldn't be what the plotters wanted. What they wanted was a continuation of the war in Vietnam and the presidency in the hand of somebody who would continue the war in Vietnam. So they had to wrestle the case out of the Public Defender's Office and get it in the hand of a lawyer they can control.
Sorry, we have to close. Okay, Oscar.
Recently I saw on KCET a story about the killing of Kennedy, and it said that he's saying about his trips to the Soviet Union.
About what?
His trips to the Soviet Union during the time leading up to the assassination.
Well, I think you're talking about Oswald's trips to the Soviet Union.
Yeah. What's that?
And most researchers are of the view, and as I am of the view, that Oswald was an intelligence operative for the U.S. government, spying on the Soviet Union when he went to the Soviet Union. And that's why he could be so easily controlled. 007 go here, 007 go there. He was under command.
But he did travel over there.
Yes, yes.
And he tried to work out something with Cuba. He was in favor of Cuba there for a while.
No, I think that Oswald...
But he was jumping back and forth. Sometimes he was, and sometimes he wasn't.
No, Oswald was all the time a U.S. government intelligence operative. But when he, apparently, if his girlfriend is to be believed, when he stumbled across, or when he came across evidence that there was a plot against the candidate, against the president, to murder the president, he didn't want that to happen. But I think that he was involved consciously with U.S. intelligence in its anti-Castro operations, and certainly in spying against the Soviet Union.
Okay.
Now, let me just emphasize one more thing. There is something you can all do here before you leave. I have a petition that I'd like to ask you to sign requesting that the governor of California grant executive clemency to Sirhan. Sirhan is not guilty. He didn't do anything. His crime is that he was too curious about hypnosis. He went to a few too many hypnosis demonstrations, got picked up, and manipulated. That's his crime. He didn't shoot Robert Kennedy. The autopsy report proves that. He also was in a trance and not conscious. I have the best expert in hypnosis in the United States who has reached that conclusion, and it's overwhelmingly provable. So Sirhan should be released as a result of an order from the governor. Second, I have another petition that I would ask you to sign that calls upon the U.S. Attorney, the Attorney General of the United States, to investigate the atrocious conduct that took place in the U.S. Attorney's office in Los Angeles of blackmailing Grant Cooper into throwing the biggest case, the biggest trial in 20th century U.S. history. I'd ask you to sign both of those before you leave. So there is something you can do, and you can do those two things.
Hope to see everyone back here at 1 o'clock on Sunday for Kathy Kelly's talk from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock.